Chapter 76. Death of a Dream. I was having difficulty settling into the weekly rhythm of the sewing workshop at the Manzini Industrial Training Center, located in the lowlands of Swaziland. As Easter approached, there was talk of a road trip to Johannesburg, over the border in the Republic of South Africa, and I was invited to join the party. At the outset, I was somewhat reluctant until it was explained that because classes ran all year long at the training center, there were no between-term holidays. Now in the know, I realized that this trip was too good to miss, so I decided to tag along, particularly when I discovered a visit to Soweto was on the itinerary. Over the years, I'd heard mention of Johannesburg in conjunction with Nelson Mandela. I knew that he and Oliver Tambo had set up their legal practice there in 1952, commuting daily from Soweto, the dormitory suburb for labor, some 25 kilometers from the city. They were in partnership until 1962, when Mandela was arrested, tried, and imprisoned for opposing South Africa's apartheid system. To get to Johannesburg, we crossed the Swazi-South African border at Oshoek, where our passports were checked and stamped by an immigration official. The border post was guarded by a group of young soldiers with blonde hair and blue eyes, dressed in camouflage print uniforms, each carrying an assault rifle. Some kilometers into South Africa, I noticed the roads widened to become two, and sometimes three lanes, each side of a central island with tall pole lights, spaced at regular intervals, and hardly any traffic. And I wondered why? Later I'd find out. When we arrived in Johannesburg, our Afrikaner hosts offered us accommodation, in a partly renovated house, in an outlying lower-class white suburb. I was struck by the antiquated bathroom and kitchen fit-out. It was as though the clock had stopped in the late 1950s. The kitchen, with its faded lime-green laminex work surfaces, its small wooden table and a cluster of chrome-legged chairs, were the lasting legacy of economic sanctions imposed on South Africa in 1963, bringing the importation of most things to a standstill for 30 years. Next day we drove out to the Soweto township. As we neared the township, tension in the car ramped up, because carjacking was always a possibility. And tension was further heightened when we got caught in a queue of cars and small buses, crawling along the perimeter road. As we inched our way along, I could see past the row of portable toilets lining the road into the sprawling shantytown, with its grim clusters of small makeshift humpies. We were shocked to see the extent of poverty, evidence of apartheid writ large. Shaken by the experience, we were eager to return to the relative comfort of our billet. Before returning to Swaziland, we popped in to do last-minute shopping at an upmarket complex on the outskirts of the city. As I needed nothing, I chose to wait on a bench in the warm sunshine and watch the steady stream of people walking by. I became aware that I too was being watched, and, whenever I turned my head and made eye contact, the watcher's eyes would drop. I found this strange, but accepted it was normal in South Africa at that time. Shopping done, we drove back to Swaziland along the perfectly engineered bitumen highway. As there was very little traffic, I was prompted to ask the question I'd been chewing over since we entered the Republic, 3 days earlier. Why were there so many magnificent 4- and 6-lane highways when there were so few cars? Then came the chilling answer. To get trips to any part of the Republic fast, if there is trouble. I assume trouble referred to a black revolt. In 1992, Nelson Mandela was apartheid South Africa's worrying preoccupation. He'd been released from prison in 1990, and the country had been on edge ever since. I could feel the waves of pro-African National Congress energy crashing over Swaziland. This tiny country provided the perfect vantage point for the rest of the world to watch what was happening over the border in the Republic. My feelings of disquiet regarding this potentially dangerous situation were confirmed in an unexpectedly candid conversation I had with a Swazi colleague on my return from Johannesburg. After our weekend away, we each resumed our lives in Manzini. For me, all that remained of our visit was a collection of troubling memories. One Saturday afternoon some weeks later, the Anglican nuns who ran the training center invited me to go with them to visit the Mkaya Game Reserve, not far from Manzini. On the way, we passed a cluster of traditional Swazi houses with exquisite domed grass roofs, held in place by a net of finely plaited grass. I was fascinated by the construction. Arriving at Mkaya, we ordered high tea, which was served on the veranda overlooking the large muddy wallow. A rhinoceros ambled down to drink, followed by a group of noisy warthogs, and a dust-up seemed inevitable. From the safety of the veranda, we watched fascinated, as the rhinoceros charged the warthogs, scattering them. When the kerfuffle was over, we returned to sip Earl Grey tea, nibble our cucumber sandwiches, and make small talk. Another weekend excursion was to visit a resort south of Manzini that was patronized by the local elite, as well as tourists from South Africa. Comfortable wooden chairs were grouped around a largish swimming pool that was framed by closely mown lawns. It was so strange to see the picture-perfect swimming pool and lush green grass, juxtaposed against the backdrop of bone-dry hills as far as the eye could see. But this resort setup was understated, compared to the swank, multi-storied casino and brothels near Mbabane, the capital of Swaziland. Gambling and prostitution were against the law in Calvinist South Africa, so neighboring Swaziland provided the necessary facilities. The longer I spent in Swaziland, the greater my disillusionment, as I heard unsettling stories about financial aid received from developed countries. Until then, I'd seriously considered a career change. My long-term plan was to turn my back on art, make a huge success of my Swazi assignment, and return to Australia to find an exciting job with a non-government organization. Sadly, my plan was slowly disintegrating. It was becoming more and more difficult for me to run the sewing workshop, because I was in constant pain. My boss suspected something was wrong and asked me, "Are you happy?" To which I replied, "No." So she suggested an alternative. She'd give me two competent stitchers who'd make up my designs to sell. This initiative would provide income generation of a different kind for the center. I considered her offer, but it seemed my initial impulse to save the Swazis had all but evaporated. I realized I'd come a long way to discover that the Swazis were just fine, but I was the one with the problem, so I declined the offer. When things were at their lowest ebb, my friend from Toowoomba, who was temporarily living in South Africa, decided to drive to Manzini to check out my situation. I gave her a tour of the sewing workshop, after which she took me aside and quietly said, "Morley, I think you'd best come back to Toowoomba and do a master's degree." I was tempted, but as I was only 3 months into a 2-year contract, it wasn't possible. But as my physical, emotional, and mental health continued to deteriorate, I realized I could no longer carry on, and it'd be best for me to return to Australia, whilst I could still walk. My boss then phoned the Overseas Service Bureau to make the necessary arrangements to get me home. Before leaving Swaziland, I did a quick dash to an art gallery in Mbabane to buy a couple of Zulu beer baskets, a length of hand-woven silk kente cloth from Ghana, and an exquisite Xhosa women's shawl, decorated with strips of black bias binding, pearl buttons, and black, white, and red glass beads, all beautiful mementos of a misguided but life-changing adventure. I was so relieved to return to Toowoomba, high up on top of the Great Dividing Range. The city's established trees and green spaces were in marked contrast to the drought-ravaged country I'd just left. A string of medical appointments followed, and I was thankful that the X-rays showed no skeletal damage. So, if there was nothing wrong with my body, it must be my psyche that was in need of help to make sense of the Swazi experience. To do this, I needed to find a good therapist, and fast. On reflection. World service. I may have picked up on the notion of world service well before my time at the Findhorn Foundation, because my parents were both world servers of a kind. In the late 1960s and early 70s, my father was working with the United Nations International Labour Organization in Kenya, and my mother with the Department of Trade and Industry in the New Guinea Highlands. They both set up useful projects, but there was definitely an element of self-service in the mix, as well as the status that came from their successes. But things had changed. Fast forward to 1992, when an Australian volunteer abroad with a university degree like me was paid a Swazi university graduate's wage. This was enough to live on, but buying a vehicle was out of the question. Managing trainees. Before Swaziland, I'd functioned as a one-woman band, both before and after the advent of my Goulburn production studio. I taught textile skills to adults, but had zero experience organizing a group of beginner stitchers into a cohesive income-generating operation. The managerial aspect wasn't mentioned in the various briefings I'd had before accepting the placement, and came as a huge shock. My future career plans had been completely shattered. Before Swaziland, I had it all worked out. I intended to use my successful 2-year placement as a springboard into a job with a non-government organization, somewhere in the world. But the best laid plans sometimes come to naught. Little did I know that there was something even more exciting in store for me, but before I got there, I needed to make sense of my Swazi experience. To do this, I spent 12 months in therapy. Facts. Black Revolt. When I was in South Africa in 1992, the threat of a black revolt was an ever-present concern for the ruling class, because disenfranchised black South Africans made up more than half of the country's population. Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela was imprisoned for conspiring to overthrow the state. He served 27 years, split between Robben Island, Victor Verster Prison, and finally Polesmoor Prison, south of Cape Town. Moving him to Polesmoor made him more accessible to discuss dismantling apartheid with Presidents Botha and de Klerk. In 1990, amid growing domestic and international pressure and the rising fear of a racial revolt, Mandela was released. Working together, Mandela and de Klerk negotiated an end to apartheid and, in 1994, Mandela led the African National Congress to victory in the country's first multiracial general election. He became the Republic of South Africa's first democratically elected president. Economic sanctions on South Africa. The imposition of sanctions threw the country back onto its own resources.